Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I'm obligated to tell you at this point that The Personal Wealth Coach is not merely a riveting radio reconstruction
program.
Broadcast,
yes. And by riveting, we mean hot metal being pressed together firmly to any listener.
Right. Burn your brain. It is also the name of an investment advisory firm that manages investment portfolios in Salado, Texas, and whose primary regulator and is registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. And that was part of a disclosure. The disclaimer is that nothing that we say on this radio program should be listened to.
They already knew that.
Okay. Nothing that we say on this radio program should be considered individual advice, and that we get information from sources that we consider to be reliable, but there's no guarantee that they know what the heck they're talking about.
Well, there's no guarantee that we know what the heck we're talking about either.
That's true.
I think that if and we just precurse every statement by anyone we meet with, there's no guarantee that anyone knows what they're talking about.
Right. There's nobody. Does anyone really know what time it is?
Where?
Yes.
And if you really think about time for a moment, and I don't mean time in the physics
sense.
Think
about time for a moment.
Yes, in a moment. Not in the physics sense, but in the clock sense. Mm-hmm. We've just got some arbitrary rules that mean that if you step 1 foot in a direction at the right places, then you move an hour.
Or a day. Well, actually, you couldn't step. You'd have to swim to have a day change.
So we don't really have a good standardized system of time because our planet doesn't have a good standardized system of time.
Right.
It's nighttime daytime at the same time.
But it all started with the railroads.
Yeah, well, you got to make sure they're on time. Well, you know, it would be a lot better for the airlines if they could just say, well, we were on time by our version of the clock
system.
Oh,
yeah, that makes perfectly good sense. Well, this week the market went up and down and up and wound up down a little bit compared with where it started the week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.44%.
Wait, how many hundredths of 1%?
0.44%. It was a major move to 2804.84. But the Standard & Poor's 500 lost 0.4%, not 0.44, which is a little more than 0.4. Actually, I didn't think it lost that much. Anyway, it closed out at 2381.73, and if you'd gone to bed if you'd woken up at the end of the week after going to bed at the beginning of the week, you'd be really, really well rested.
Either that or have been in a coma.
Right.
You may not be listening to the program.
You would have missed the fact that there was a pretty good drop, 1.8% drop on Wednesday when apparently the traders accidentally switched channels from
the economy to politics.
Yeah, they looked at Washington for just a little bit, and it scared them so bad that a lot of people said sell, sell, sell.
Right. What it was is that someone said you need to listen to the trader channel, and they thought that someone had said traitor rather than trade-door.
Wait,
there's some news on traitors. No, this is the wrong channel. Let's go back. Never mind, that's politics.
They switched back to MSNBC and kept on going.
Right.
Yeah,
I'm not sure that MSNBC is what they're – some kind of financial
well,
– I don't know.
There's a lot of – MSNBC has a lot of financial stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the market was down a little bit for the week. It's one of those things. The market's going to do that a little bit. Jeremy Siegel came out with an announcement in Barron's today.
We have to say who that is first. Because most people do not know who Jeremy Siegel is. We do.
They don't?
And we think that it'd be absurd. It'd be like somebody coming up to us and saying, fill in the blank sports star.
LeBron.
He's a baseball player, right?
I don't know.
See, that's where we are with sports. And people go, how can you not know that?
LeBron does such and such. And I thought, cool.
Well, I don't know who he is or what he's doing. That's how we feel.
It could be what he is. You know?
Yeah, when someone says, who's Jeremy Siegel? Because in the world of economics, He's be the equivalent of whoever LeBron is because he's in the headlines.
Yeah, well, that and last year at this time, and he does this pretty regularly, he says, here's what I think the stock market's going to do over the next year. And it does pretty much what he says it is going to do. And I don't know whether the stock market is listening to Jeremy Siegel or he's just really smart. And we have a – did it go away?
No, it's there.
Okay, we have a caller on 773-1400. You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, this is Ron in Toledo. How y'all doing?
Great. I think we're okay.
Good. I have a couple of quick questions. Here about 3 months ago, there was quite a bit of talk about taking the U.S. dollar away and make it a cashless society.
There was?
I heard it.
Okay.
So I wondered, you guys are very smart about money, and I just wondered if, number one, you thought they would ever do that, and number two, how do you think they would do it if they did it?
All right. Mm. Good question.
Yeah, that is a pretty good question because it's kind of creeping up on us.
The vast
majority of money that is transferred around and used to buy and sell things isn't cash now.
Yeah. The cash as a percentage of the wealth in our economy is very tiny percents of 1%. We're getting into extreme, and there was no governmental movement to do that. We just, you know, for instance, I think I've got some $1 bills in my pocket right now. Let me see what I've got. Two $1 bills, which I would use to tip someone for carrying a bag or something. The rest of my money is in debit cards and in credit cards. And while that is a problem if the power goes out, I do have a small amount of cash in a safe. But the reality is that on my day-to-day life, I don't need cash. And that becomes an influence. Now, in India, they've done some things very recently that have disrupted the system extremely. Because India is a much more cash-based economy than ours, and the prime minister over there just got rid of the largest denomination bill. And when that happened, that's what most of the large financial transactions take place in. Where here, I mean, if you wanted to buy a house and you had to show up with a briefcase full of $100 bills...
It'd be more like a suitcase.
It depends on how long the brief is. It's a very long brief. A brief, long thing. A long brief thing? I don't know.
Well, there's, you know, let me say that at some point, I wouldn't be surprised to see us get rid of the $100 bill. And the reason, and that would take things down dramatically. There are a lot more.
I would like to get rid of the penny first, though.
Well,
for instance,
the $100 bill is the item of, there are actually more $100 bills in circulation than there are pennies.
Yeah, and this
and the reason is because a lot of illegal transactions, like drug transactions, take place using cash, so that the authorities can't figure out that illegal money laundering and transactions like that are going on. As a matter of fact, I had I used to know a guy who was who worked for the Treasury, Secret Service, and among other things, they go after money and stuff like that. And he said that you can take virtually any $100 bills and scan it for cocaine, and it'll come up positive.
Yeah.
So will there ever come a time when we go cashless? Yeah, I think it could happen. Do I think it's likely to happen in the foreseeable future? No, because we're just not there yet.
Yeah,
but
there needs to be something
20 years from now
easily
maybe.
Replace it. This is a better example. This is a better way of saying how it happens. The government gets involved after the fact in the United States. When money in the United States went from metal, an actual gold or silver coin.
Specie.
To paper, it was well after most people weren't carrying around huge amounts of metal coins because they were writing checks. So they were saying this is a value based on a bank. Well, that's all a dollar is. It's a value based on the bank. Even when it was based in gold or silver, you weren't allowed to melt that down. That's called defacing currency. You're not allowed to take currency and turn it into its base metal. You were, again, allowed to do that for a while, but just a few years back, they made it illegal to do for pennies because people were taking the penny and melting it down for copper and getting like 2 cents worth of copper out of it.
In fact, at present, if you will, if you were to x-ray anything other than coins that you have, you will find that there's a metallic thread.
Or a plastic thread.
But they're basically, even the cash we have has an electronic signature. And I really do think eventually we'll go to what is referred to as a cashless society. And I think it's just a matter of convenience.
I think it's still going to be cash. It's just not going to be, I mean, I consider my debit card to be cash.
Right. But I'm talking about getting rid of.
But it's not a physical piece of thing that. This is another example. This is a really good one. Bearer bonds used to be what bonds were. You just basically, that's what it was. You would get a piece of paper that had perforated edges, kind of like coupons, which is why they call it the coupon rate, by the way. And you would rip out those little things and you would take it to the bank and you would hand it in and they would give you money for your interest. Bearer bonds meant that whoever was the bearer of the bond got the money. Well, they haven't been issuing bearer bonds for decades. The only bearer bonds still out there are really old, mm-hmm. just like they don't issue stock certificates in paper form anymore. If you want to go get a Walmart stock certificate, you're going to have to dig through an antique store at this point because they don't issue paper. And if you want to exchange the stock for money, you have to get it electronically filed, and then they destroy the paper because it's a lot easier to keep up with electronic records than it is with paper records. Mm-hmm. Anybody that has tried to look back at what they paid for their electric bill 3 years ago will tell you it's a lot easier to look electronically than in paper because you got to find the thing first. And even if you have a drawer that's associated just with your electric bills, 3 years ago is 36 payments ago, and hopefully you have it in the right order. It's up to whatever your filing system was. It's a lot easier to electronically file what you did and what other people did. And if you're a business owner and someone is just buying in cash from you, it's a repeat customer. One, you got to count all the cash every time, which is a time drain. It's a, why are you paying me in cash? Okay, now I have to do something with this cash. There's extra reporting requirements. We got to put this away somewhere where it doesn't just walk off
the.
Yeah, if your employee's standing around, you got to make sure. I mean, you obviously people try to trust their employees, but if there's a stack of cash, that's been a great cause of theft over the years. The concept of not knowing who owns the money when you spend it is the problem with it. If we certainly don't do that with houses. Everybody knows who owns the house. It's registered. As long as we can trust that the money's not ill-gotten, that we can trust the person who's spending the money, then it's okay to have cash. If we can't trust the person, then taking that cash is a crime.
There was a move, I think it was in the Clinton administration, to eliminate the $100 bill. And there was a lot of, because it would dramatically reduce smuggling and drug transactions.
It's not going to happen like that.
But the State Department respectfully asked the Treasury and the President not to do that because it would destabilize Russia.
Yeah. And they used the black market in Russia is dollar bound.
Right. And it's the same thing is true. There's basically countries around the world where their economy runs on $100 bills, U.S. $100 bills. And for instance, the Fed requested the Treasury, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, to print a lot more $100 bills because there was gradual shortage occurring in the global economy of $100 bills. And it could create a global financial crisis because so many countries around the world, including, I might add, Russia and China, use $100 bills for many of their foreign transactions.
Yeah.
So
now, most
I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon.
Yeah. What we see here. Go ahead, caller.
If you travel anywhere and want to buy something, at a shop or something, I bet there's not 5% where you can't.
Yeah, with a $100 bill? Right. But I can also say there's not 5% where you can't haul out your Visa card, and it's far more, and it's a lot cheaper. Let me tell you, I've done both. I've tried to use cash and the Visa card, and they charge a premium. In other words, they charge a percentage, often 5% extra if you want to use U.S. dollars, whereas if I use the Visa card, I don't have that charge.
You just have the exchange rate with a very small fee, very small compared to what you would get if you were just using cash everywhere.
It'll go away eventually.
And this comes back to what I was saying earlier. The history of the United States, monetary changes like this take place after the market's already done it. It's not led by the government. The government doesn't step in and say, we're going to take away a popular thing. They can't do that because we have a government that's elected in a popular vote. So if they take away popular things, they don't get reelected.
There was an attempt.
Like y'all were talking, and do away with the 100, and then do away with the 50. And
right, it'll be
like, a long time out.
You know, there used to be a $1,000 bill and a $500 bill, and those were recalled.
Well, they started out with $10,000 bill.
Right. Well, you know, we had arguably the worst depression in the history of the United States began in 1837. It was in many ways worse than 1929. And it started with the President of the United States determining that banknotes issued by banks, which is basically what a Visa and a MasterCard are.
They're issued by a large bank.
Are no longer acceptable. Were no longer acceptable currency to the United States government. And it created – it was the immediate cause of the Great Depression of 1837. That ultimately led to the Civil War.
And the strengthening of Texas as a nation and then as a state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that concept of removing value from banks has led in almost every country that you look at has led directly to massive depressions and usually the replacement of the government.
Right, so probably not a good idea. All right, anything else?
That's it.
All right, thank you for calling.
Ron, are you the same Ron who's famous for very sour liquids?
Well, I have to plead guilty to that.
All right. Well, it's good to hear from you again. It's been a long time.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
All right, thanks for calling. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Sour liquids?
Yeah. I won't go into detail. He hasn't done it, but think lemon juice.
Oh, okay.
Right.
I'm not even going to ask any questions about that.
Right.
Okay. Let's see. There's some other things that went on. You want the good news or you want the good news?
Can you let's do the good news then.
Okay. Well, in April of 2017, there is this index that the Federal Reserve tracks. It's called the G17. It's industrial production.
Right.
And now this is not annualized. In the month of April, industrial production in the United States jumped 1%. Now, I don't mean at an annualized rate of 1%. I mean, it was up a whopping 1%. And to give you some idea, in January, it was down 0.3. In February, it was up 0.2. In March, it was up 0.4. And in April, it jumped 1.0. Year over year, it's up 2.2%. Now, that by itself is pretty impressive. But the thing that we've seen in the past is industrial production jumps like this that have happened in the last decade or so, almost always where, well, we pumped a lot of oil out of the ground or we mined a lot of minerals out of the ground or something. In other words, we didn't actually produce something in the sense that you think of manufacturing. But this time around, it's a little different. 0.7 of that 1% jump was actual manufacturing. That was actually, you know, making stuff, big metal, tractors, washing machines, things of that nature. So we've seen this this rather substantial rise in 1 month and year over year.
in the thing that a lot of people think highly of, and this is fascinating to me, for the same month when everything went up 1%, when manufacturing went up 1%, crude oil dropped 0.4%. In other words, the amount of oil we pumped out of the ground was 0.4%, of, at least in dollar terms, 0.4% less than it was the previous month. So it didn't add to this. That's significant, and it's even more significant when you look at their the other thing that the Fed comes out, this same report, this G17 report, is they look at capacity utilization. And our capacity – now, what do you
– what is it? Capacity utilization? What does that even mean?
We get into recessions when our capacity utilization gets too high.
Okay. What does that mean? Let's say that. Capacity, that's how much you can do. And if you are – for instance, let's talk railroads. That's an easy one to say.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if there are –
railroads.
Railroads.
It's easy one to say.
Yes. If there are a lot of trains on the railroads, at some point you can put too many trains on there. Because if you've got to go in both directions, it's really hard to use the same two tracks to go both directions at the same time. So capacity utilization has to do with how long it takes for trains to have to stop and wait for another train to go by. How it basically, it's traffic, if you think of it that way. Capacity utilization is how clogged is our traffic way for money, for industrial production, for railroad transportation.
Well, in this case,
everything
in
industry
this case,
is what we're talking about here.
It is the manufacturing capacity utilization. In other words, we have a factory, and it can produce, let's say, 100,000 widgets a year or a month.
Oh, good. I need to buy a widget right away.
And if it's only producing, instead of producing 100,000, it's only producing 62,000.
That's not good.
Then it, well, it's okay.
I mean,
it's
not bad.
60, then that's where our manufacturing economy is right now. We're at 62% capacity utilization. And
which
when we get up to around 80%, we get into danger zone because somewhere there is some industry, there is some critical component, some that in the process of making widgets, there's critical components. There's some critical component out there that's at 100% by the time you get to 82 across the board.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot of room to expand.
Let me throw something
in
here.
But we are expanding.
62% is what you said, right?
Right.
Well, 62% is not the sweet spot, but it's well into healthy territory. If your capacity utilization is down in the 50s, it means you're not making enough profit generally to keep the plant open, which is where we were in the recession. In the lower 60s, you're making a profit. You're not in any great danger of breaking your machines because you've got plenty of downtime for each machine to be repaired. Once you get up into the 70% range, you start breaking machines, and when you get into the 80% range, it's just a matter of time till things start falling apart. Just think of it in terms of a boat on the water. If you run it up at full acceleration the entire time, eventually you're either going to hit something or your engine's going to break.
I misstated. It's at 76.7.
76. Okay. So that's the point where I was saying this.
Yeah.
That means that we're still got some healthy room.
But the capacity growth was 0.7% over the last year,
which tells us that we're in good shape. That's mm-hmm. Those are really, really good numbers.
So we've got very reasonable growth going on. And the consumer, and this is something I'm sure you followed almost daily, listeners, but consumer spending has not been as high as a lot of economists would like it to be, and that's a big chunk of our economy.
I would say that most listeners do follow that, only it's more likely that most listeners lead that in that they do consumer spending.
Yeah, they don't
spending.
Follow it, they lead it.
They see, do the consumer spending, and we just read about it. So we're following our listeners in this one.
And we've talked about the fact that what's happening in the economy right now, a large portion of it that's not happening. And the reason we're not seeing one of the reasons we're not seeing particularly fast growth is uncertainty. And both business and consumers are expressing a degree that they come across on the surveys as saying, hey, we're very confident. We think everything is really going to be great. We're really feeling good about everything. And we've got some information about that.
But they're still saving a lot of money and not spending a lot of money.
Right. They're paying down their debts. storing money in savings and not spending as they have in the past. And that is an indication that they really are uncertain about something.
They are not confident.
If you drill down deeply, what they're saying is the people who do spend a lot of money and who make a lot of the difference are the upper income people, and they don't have a clue what their tax rate will be next year.
Right.
And they don't even know what their tax rate will be this week. In other words, Congress could pass a tax bill, change the tax rates this year.
And we don't know what we owe.
And they can retroactively said you owe the tax back to January 1st. So people are
concerned,
being a little reluctant to
mildly
spend a lot of money. They want to have money to pay their taxes.
So if you look at these surveys about confidence and you look about confidence in the economic world, by and large, the vast majority of the United States citizens are saying that they're confident in the economy right now. They're doing better than they were last year, and so is everybody else that they know.
And by the way, car sales are falling off too.
Right. Well, that was kind of expected. There was a big glut that needed to be grabbed out.
Deglutted.
Deglutted, yes.
But that
confidence is now – we're still confident. If you ask everybody around, we're confident that the economy is going to be good next year too. But you may not be willing to spend because what you said, we don't know about taxes. We don't know about health insurance. There are other factors, and Ed mentioned this in his program right before ours. Student loan rates are really getting to be a burden. The younger generation is paying down debts and saving because they have to in order to make any progress forward. We've never seen the concentration of debt that we're seeing in the younger generation. Generally, debt concentrates in the middle-aged group, and right now, the debt is concentrated in the young educated group. Well, the young educated group is the group in demographics that we look for to do the most spending and to do the most innovation. And basically, we put shackles around their feet or ankles or something to slow them down. That's going to have an impact on the economy for a very long period of time. That confidence, also, this is the same group that grew up watching their parents and their aunts and their uncles and everybody else that they knew go through a horrible recession.
Yep, that's real. Hey, and you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'd love to have a call from you with any questions or thoughts you have. We have some more good news.
Yeah.
We have some commercials to play.
We've got commercials to play. We've got good news. I have a piece of kind of trivial information to throw out there. The legislative session is underway right now in Texas, and we are all in Texas very proud of the fact that we don't have an income tax, that the state does not have an income tax. But this is a piece of trivia. It's a nice piece of trivia. The single largest reported major source of revenue to the state, what would you say it is?
Sales tax.
Well, that's a good guess, but it's wrong. It's the second, but it's
Earl.
Not even close.
All right, what is it?
Federal income tax.
Wait a minute. The state receives money from federal income tax.
Yep.
Rebates?
Medicare.
Ah.
Medicaid.
Oh.
What the state receives back for transportation, for a lot of things from the federal government that it then distributes on to schools and to other programs is the largest piece of revenue to the state. They received, as of 2015, $36.7 billion in a year from federal income taxes. Our sales down. So listen to that just a second. Almost $37 billion. Sales tax amounted to $29 billion. So there's a large difference between the two.
So what you're trying to say is when we annexed the United States in 1845,
it was a healthy move. That's what we're saying.
It basically was a good move.
Yes, that's what we're saying. Well, the fact is that we still receive back from the federal government less than we put in. Most years.
Well,
this year, we're receiving back more. During the recession, because we were in great shape, our income tax rates didn't drop, our income tax revenue to the federal government didn't drop as much as the rest of the country. So during the recession, we were paying out more than we were receiving back from the rest of the country. But most of the time, we receive back more than we pay in.
By the way, I don't know if this is still true. It was several years ago that I looked at this, and I suspect it's still true. If you actually look at cash flows, income tax paid to the United States government versus the amount of government money that flows into a local community, the best the best relationship in the nation, in other words, of all the of the entire United States, the place that has the greatest positive cash flow back from the federal government is Bell County, Texas.
Yes, because of Fort Hood.
Yes.
Because there are a great number of people here who receive the 100% of their pay from the United States government. And even if they take back the normal tax that they take out of everybody's pay, the reality is that there's that big offset. Well, plus, we also get transportation above average because the federally paid for railroad and highway system coming to Bell County has to be there to take people in uniform to both coasts to get them to other places very quickly. And you're looking at your computer.
No, I was just looking at the wires over there.
Ah, okay.
The it is certainly a and there is another factor, a little factor there, and that is the people on Fort Hood who wear the same clothes every day.
Right.
The uniformed members of the armed forces.
It's a piece of convenience.
Right,
they don't have to make that choice every day.
Get a significant portion of their pay without paying any form of income tax on them.
That's correct.
That's called their housing allowance.
There's
that
another
flows
piece
back
too.
Into the community. What else?
The retirees in the area. A large percentage of those military retirees have some form of disability. Their knees aren't working well because they banged them really hard a lot of times while wearing heavy boots. Their shoulders aren't working well because they were picking up very, very heavy explosive devices again and again all day long. The money that they're paid for disability is also income tax free.
So we have this real advantage. We have a relatively low tax rate in Bell County, and we have a high income rate from the federal government. So bashing the federal government and people who don't pay taxes in Bell County is probably not a particularly good idea.
Right. Now, the fact is that the people that don't pay taxes in Bell County earned it.
Right.
That's kind of an important piece.
Right. So it's probably a good idea to play commercials
yes.
on that note.
Now, after that, a wonderful piece of useless trivia that you can use at any cocktail party, sound intelligent, and then have no other great benefit in your life from. All right, so we'll be back on the other side. Again, if you'd like to call us and join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. We'd love for you to give us a call and stir our semi-somnolent brains into activity.
Yours may be semi-somnolent. Mine is fully somnolent.
I'm going to run out of stories to talk about. But
you've got good news.
The Federal Reserve Board did a survey.
I'm glad they're doing something with their time.
And what they said, and they did it during 2016, and they're just now publishing it because they are a little slow about this. But they do get their data right when they publish these things. It's slow, but well done. And what they found out is that during 2016, 70% of adults report they are either living comfortably or doing okay financially, compared with 69% in 2015 and 62% when the question is first asked in 2013. I put that wrong in the newsletter, by the way. It was 70 instead of 69, but that was pretty close because I was reading a newspaper article that apparently got it wrong. But
they just rounded it to the nearest 10, which is a good thing to do unless you're talking about taxes.
But if you don't have a college degree, if you only have a high school diploma or less, then it starts to slide downhill. And the bottom line to it is that the more education a person has and the healthier they are, the more likely they are to say, we're doing great financially. The people who, the standout people who obviously are not doing well, who are struggling, and who, if, for example, had a $400 unexpected something negative happen to them, would be unable to pay it, are pretty uniformly people with less than a college education or people who are ill. And you say, well, okay, they're ill, so they can't work. No,
they're working.
It's in many cases they're working. It's just that their medical bills are causing them to struggle and consider bankruptcy. So that is about 40% of America. And so even though we are, no, it's not 40, about 30%, 31%, I'm sorry, of America is struggling financially, while about 70% of America is doing very well financially. And it's worth taking a look, and I think maybe that's the liberal position, I don't know, but it's worth taking a look at that 30% and say, how could we better enable them? And the answer is A, better education, and B, figuring out how they could pay for healthcare.
There's another factor here, and we mentioned it in passing just a few minutes before, but you're talking about healthcare as being an important thing. Looking at the same report, it's just a, if you're a geek, the Federal Reserve surveys are the best reading. You sit and giggle and laugh and have a great time because the information pouring out of it is so good. Now, if you're not a geek, you just look at us and think, you don't even know who LeBron, I don't know LeBron's last name is, so you're a geek. Well,
does he have a last name?
I don't know. They don't use it in the headlines, so I'm not sure. Debt levels in the United States, this is one you probably are aware of as well. Debt levels just hit where they were right before the recession in 2008. Before you panic.
The total debt.
Yeah. The amount of debt, the dollar amount of debt, is at the same level it was in 2008. Before you panic and say, oh, that means we're about to hit another recession, our income rate has come way up since then. It's been almost a decade since then, and we're looking at a completely different environment. What's more, where the debt is different. We owe less. As a solid number, not as a percentage, but as a solid number, we owe less on mortgages than we did in 2007. We a lot less. We owe less in home equity lines, home equity line of credit. Those when people are taking a home equity debt to pay off credit cards or whatever, our credit card debt is lower as a solid number. The two areas that is making the difference, and these are areas that one of them is going up rather steeply and the other one is going up rather slowly. And what you just said means it's going to go down for a while. Student loan debt is way up, and that's a consistently up figure. And during the recession, it went up faster. And that's something people should know because a lot of people that were out of work went back to school and they paid for it with debt. Now, hopefully it's worth it. Hopefully what they learned allows them to make a lot more money into the future. And that's why I'm saying don't panic. While I have been saying student loans are painful, they are a drag on the economy, they're also an ability to create skills and education that are a boost to the economy. Because we're using student loan instead of cheap public funded, it's not really cheap, it comes from taxes. We're just shifting who's paying for it long term. We're putting the burden on the people going to school and their parents. That slows down their growth rate at the beginning. And it's one of the things, this is an experiment. It's going to be interesting to see how it winds up. But the debt that we're seeing is auto loans and student loans. And what you just said about auto loan sales dropping. And I mentioned auto sales dropping means that auto loans are dropping as well. And I said they needed to get rid of that glut. During the recession, the debt in the auto world dropped during a 5-year period. People had consistently lower debt in automobiles, and it dropped during that whole period. What that means is that people weren't buying new cars. They weren't even buying used cars. They were making do with the cars that they had on average. And when they were doing that on average, they were saying the whole time, well, eventually I need to get another car. Well, they all decided to do that at once in the last year and a half or 2 years. A lot of people have gone out and gotten newer cars, either new or newer cars. And that's caused the auto loans to jump up over the last 4 years. It's come up quite a bit. And what that means coming forward is that we're probably going to reach a parity. We're going to reach where it's a reasonable amount to have a car loan. And we may have already done it if auto sales are dropping at this point.
Well, you know, Ed Loeffler's in trouble too.
How so? For those of you listening nationally, he is the program that comes directly in front of us at KTEM.
And, yeah, it's called Ask a Lawyer, and he is a noted bankruptcy attorney. And apparently we've had a drop in the first quarter of 1.7% from last year in the number of bankruptcies in the United States, and it is at a record low.
Well, I don't think he's suffering too much because he's a noted expert in the field, and people go to him. But
right, there's 203,000 new bankruptcies in the United States in the first quarter, which sounds like a lot, but it's a really low number, and he only had half of them.
Right. It's good news for everyone except him. For him, that's his source of revenue, but I'm sure he can find other things. If bankruptcy goes away, I don't think he will ever.
He does divorces too.
Yeah, if bankruptcy goes away because it's not needed anymore, I think he'll be happy. He'll just find another way of helping people.
Well, actually, and the other thing is mortgages. We've had actually down to a point where we have fewer of them we're approaching a record low number
as a percentage
of delinquencies on mortgages. The people who have 620 or below who got mortgages was at an amazingly low level.
620 being a credit score, right, according to Fair Isaac, not the other four or five scores that are out there these
the
days.
Number. But the
that's Fair Isaac's credit score.
There was $18 billion worth of mortgages extended to borrowers with those low numbers, compared with $115 billion in the first quarter of 2007.
Right.
So we learned. We actually are no longer making really big mortgage loans to people who have really low credit scores. It's good that we figured this out.
You give a loan to people that can't pay it back, and amazingly, they don't pay it back. It's just a...
I don't know. You could always refinance the house.
Yeah. We'll just give you another loan. Wait, aren't we doing that with Greece? Yeah, but it's working. You just keep giving them more loans to pay off the loans, and eventually something's going to happen. Oh, boy. So, here in the United States, we discovered that doesn't work very well. In Europe, they're still testing this subject.
You got some news. I've got some
more
good news.
You were talking about how bankruptcies are down, and you're correct, except the Federal Reserve is correct, except that they're not counting the largest bankruptcy of all.
What?
Puerto Rico.
Well, that was just one bankruptcy.
Yeah, well, the number of bankruptcies may be down, but a really, really big entity declaring bankruptcy affects the numbers too. And what we see from that is that this goes to the point I was making just a moment ago, to the point that Ed is doing a great service for our economy. Without bankruptcy, we would be...
I can't believe he didn't get that case.
What's that?
The Puerto Rico case.
Oh, yeah. He should have. Yeah, he should have gotten the Puerto Rico. He'd be a great bankruptcy attorney for them.
Right.
without bankruptcy, we cannot clean up a mess. And when people say they should, you can't allow bankruptcy, they should just pay their debts, they shouldn't have gotten the debts. And what is being missed there is that without some way of orderly forgiveness of some amount of debt, the debt just stays there forever. The bank who's owed the debt has to keep it on the books forever. They can't write it off. They can't say this was a loss and we don't have it anymore. It just sits there. And until they can write it off, clean off their books, until they can say, yes, we lost money on that, it ties up their other assets, because this is true in Japan and across a large chunk of Europe. It's across a huge area in China. When people look at delinquent debt in their books, if you're a business owner, and say you've done a big job for a big corporation and their duty is to pay you in 60 days. Well, you have plans for that money when it comes in. If you don't account and say, when that money comes in, I'm either going to deposit it in a bank or I'm going to buy a new piece of equipment or something, then you're not really planning ahead very well. So the money's scheduled to come in. At the 60-day mark, it doesn't come in. But they tell you, we're going to pay. So you still keep your plan. Well, when it comes in, I'm going to do these things with it. And you put off doing those things because you expect that money to come in. It's not fun when they say the money's not coming. But it means you're now living in the world of reality. And if you needed to do those things you were waiting to do, once you wipe off that debt, and in most cases, bankruptcy doesn't say they don't owe you at all. They owe you some percentage, hopefully a large percentage of that debt, but something that they can actually pay back rather than not getting any of it. Bankruptcy allows other businesses and other banks who are owed money by people to make decisions that will positively impact their future. If you know you're not going to get money and you've been waiting for that money to do things that you really needed to do, you find another way to do them. If you're going to keep growing a business. And that's a strength in bankruptcy. It's something that the rest of the world cannot comprehend, because there's this tendency to say you owe the money, you need to pay it. And believe me, I believe that people need to pay their debts. But we all know people that got in so much that if they paid their debts, there's no way they could pay their debts. There's just absolutely no way that they can pay all the things that they owe. In which case, they have to get some of it forgiven so that they can pay any of it at all. That's what bankruptcy is. And it's a good thing that Puerto Rico is in bankruptcy right now. As bad as that is, it's so much better than what's happening with Greece.
I don't know. I mean,
we could just keep giving them loans that they're not going to pay back and keep saying, hey, look at the interest we're earning on these loans, which we never make, but we can put it on the banks as on our books as earnings. Look at our share. I mean, that's what Enron did. They issued loans to themselves, which they paid back to themselves with interest.
Hey, look, Carl Icahn can do it.
Yeah, it's true. His charities gave him a big loan of lots of money.
And then most of the money that he contributes, turns out that most of the money this he is, contributes to his charities, Carl Icahn, the takeover artist.
The hedge fund takeover artist, yes.
And it turned out he gives a lot of money to a charitable foundation.
Which
he
gets a tax write-off for.
Which he gets a tax write-off. And then the charitable foundation turns around and loans the money back to him.
At very low interest rates.
Very, very low interest rates.
Which is a lot less than tax, if you think about that.
Yes, yes. So, and so he's actually knows how to play the system pretty well.
We should elect him president.
Okay.
Of some organization.
Yes, something like that. We're almost out of time for the first hour, but I did want to throw one more piece of good information in there, information that is at least pleasant to us. The conference board since 1955, actually the LBER, Bureau of Economic Research.
Yes, and the conference board is a group in
The government in the in the Commerce Department until 1995 under Clinton, from 1955 to 1995, issued leading economic indicators and from the Bureau of Economic Research. But they decided they had one too many bureau or something, so they got rid of the Bureau of Economic Research.
This doesn't need to be done by the government anymore. Somebody else do this.
They moved all the people to the Bureau of Economic Analysis or something. Any rate, they turned it over to the Conference Board, which is a nonprofit organization that's been around quite a while, actually started in 1917. Well, here's the key about the leading economic indicators that first the government did and now the Conference Board does.
Using the same methods.
Yes. They've never missed a recession. Now, they've called numerous recessions that didn't happen, but there's never been a recession hit the United States since – since 1917, when they first started doing these less accurate, but still they were doing leading economic indicators. We've never had a recession hit that wasn't preceded by several months of falling economic indicators, at least 3 months.
Right.
Leading economic indicators.
And that's why they call them leading, is because they come in advance.
And so they look at 3 months at a time. So the conference board announced on May 18th that the economic indicators, leading economic indicators, rose 0.3% in April, following a 0.3% increase in March and a 0.5% increase in February, which means
we're on track still for about the same growth rate that we've had.
Right. And we have a window of 6 months out there when it's extremely unlikely we could have a recession.
Right. And when we're looking at full employment now.
We'll talk about that. Yeah, more. There's a whole subject matter around
full
employment.
Lots more stuff to talk about going forward. If you would like to contact us off the air, we'll be back next hour, but if you'd like to contact us off the air, you can reach our voicemail during the week and real live people during the voicemail during the weekend. Real live people during the week, which would be locally
at 254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
And you can reach that toll-free 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, which is thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and listen to podcasts. You can read our philosophy and the newsletter we put out every week.
And see
sign
our
up.
Made for radio faces.
Yes, our made for radio faces and our beautiful staff. And this is a lot of fun. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next hour.
Fair, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.